Have you ever caught yourself mid-sentence, mid-explanation, mid-update, mid-vent, and felt for a second that you weren't really communicating, you were trying to secure your place in the room? Because a lot of us don't realize how much of life we spend performing until we try to stop performing. We talk to feel safe. We explain to feel understood. We post to feel real. We hint to feel interesting. We promise to feel committed. We update people to feel like we're moving. And the strangest part is that all of this can create a substitute life, one that feels active, even intense, while the real work stays untouched. Stoicism has a quiet way of cutting through that illusion. Not with hype, with a simple reminder: your life is not what you say. Your life is what you repeatedly do. Epictetus would call it the difference between what's up to you and what isn't. Your attention, your judgments, your actions are yours, but the crowd's reaction is not. And the moment you start living for reaction, you hand away the steering wheel. Marcus Aurelius wrote to himself like a man guarding a fragile flame, reminding his own mind to stay steady, to stop begging the world for approval, to stop trading inner freedom for outer noise. So the shift this episode is built on is simple and brutal in the best way. The day you keep your mouth shut, strategically with self-respect, is the day your life stops being a story and starts becoming evidence. From that point on, the changes aren't mystical, they're mechanical, because less noise creates more focus. Focus creates better decisions. Better decisions create momentum, and momentum changes everything. As you listen, try one small experiment that takes no effort but changes your awareness. The next time you feel the urge to explain yourself, pause for 3 seconds and ask, "Is this necessary? Or am I trying to feel safe?" That tiny gap is where power begins, because that gap is where choice lives. And once you can create that gap, your goals stop dying early, because you stop cashing in the emotional reward before the work is done. 1. Your goals stop dying early. Have you ever noticed how a goal feels most alive right at the beginning, when it's still clean in your mind, still untouched by difficulty, still full of possibility, and then, almost quietly, it starts to fade? Not because you decided to quit, but because the energy that was supposed to carry it forward somehow leaked out. For a lot of people, that leak happens through the mouth. You tell someone what you're about to do. You describe the plan. You talk about the new routine. You hint at the big change. You drop a few lines that say, "I'm different now." And for a moment, it feels good. You feel seen. You feel supported. You feel like you've already moved. But the uncomfortable truth is that the brain often treats social recognition like progress, and the moment you receive that small emotional reward, your urgency softens. You didn't do the work, but you got the feeling you were becoming someone who does the work. Stoicism has a sharp way of naming this without drama. Don't confuse the appearance of virtue with virtue itself. Epictetus would say that what matters is what you can control, your choices and actions, not the story you tell about them. And Marcus Aurelius, writing privately to himself, keeps returning to the same standard. Stop performing, start practicing. Because performance gives you a quick sense of identity, and practice gives you the real thing. This is why many goals die early. They don't die from failure. They die from premature relief. It's like spending money you haven't earned yet. You cash in the emotional paycheck before you've done the shift. And then, when the real shift arrives, the boring repetition, the resistance, the days you don't feel like it, you reach for the same fuel that helped you start: external reassurance. You want someone to tell you you're still on track. You want to explain why you slowed down. You want to promise you'll come back stronger. And those words soothe the discomfort temporarily, but they also keep the goal in a fragile place, because the goal becomes tied to being witnessed rather than being built. Seneca warned about this in a deeper way when he spoke about the crowd. Not because people are evil, but because attention can make you careless. It makes you trade the slow satisfaction of progress for the fast satisfaction of approval. And approval is a bad substitute for momentum. Momentum comes from action. It's earned, it compounds, it changes you from the inside, which means it can't be handed to you by a compliment. So what does silence do here, in a practical sense? Silence protects the early stage of your goal, the stage where it's most vulnerable to doubt, distraction, and other people's opinions. Not because other people are always trying to sabotage you, but because every outside voice adds weight. Some people will discourage you, some will question you, some will offer advice you didn't ask for, some will project their limits onto you. Even supportive people can become noise if they start expecting updates, expecting results, expecting you to stay consistent in the way they imagine consistency should look. When you keep your mouth shut, the goal stays clean. It stays between you and the work. And that simplicity is powerful. Here's the shift you want to make. Don't feed your ambition with attention. Feed it with proof. Proof can be tiny at first, but it has to be real. One workout, one study session, 1 hour of focused work, one boundary enforced without explanation, one day of keeping your word to yourself. These small proofs are like roots. Nobody claps for roots, but roots are why the tree survives. And this is the quiet miracle, mechanical, not mystical. Once your brain stops getting rewarded by talking, it starts craving reward from completion. You begin to feel satisfied only when something is actually done. That's when goals stop dying early, because they finally have time to mature without being interrupted by your own need to be seen. So, take this as a simple if. Then you can live by. If you feel the urge to announce a goal, then do one concrete step first and keep it private. Let the first person to hear about your goal be reality. Let the first applause be your own calm respect at the end of the day. Because when you stop narrating, you stop leaking. And when you stop leaking, your goals start living long enough to become real. 2. Your discipline gets stronger without more willpower. Have you ever noticed that discipline usually doesn't fail in the middle of the work? It fails right before the work starts, in that small moment where you're about to begin and your mind suddenly offers you 1,000 reasonable delays, and each delay sounds harmless. Until you look up and realize another day has passed, and the person you said you were becoming is still only a sentence in your head. This is where people misunderstand themselves. They think they lack willpower, but often what they really lack is a system that doesn't require willpower to function. Willpower is a mood. It's a wave. Some days it's high, some days it disappears. Stoicism, at its best, is built for the days when it disappears. Epictetus taught that freedom is not doing what you feel like doing, but being able to choose what is right, even when your feelings argue against it. And Marcus Aurelius kept returning to the same private command: do the work that is yours, without complaint, without theater, without making it a debate. Now here's the quiet problem with talking too much about discipline. It gives you a shortcut identity. When you describe who you're becoming, you begin to feel like you're already halfway there. People might even treat you like you're disciplined because they like the idea of you being disciplined. And in the short term, that feels encouraging. But in the long term, it creates a gap between your image and your proof. And that gap slowly produces shame, because you start living with the feeling that you're behind your own promises. Silence closes that gap in a very direct way. When you stop narrating your discipline, you stop getting emotional credit for intention. And once you stop getting credit for intention, the only way to feel like a disciplined person is to behave like one, repeatedly, quietly, until it becomes normal. This is why discipline can get stronger without adding any new willpower. Because the goal is no longer to feel motivated, the goal is to reduce negotiation. Most people lose to themselves because they keep arguing with themselves. They wake up and bargain, they plan and bargain, they sit down to work and bargain, and by the time they're done bargaining, they've spent the energy that was supposed to go into action. Seneca would say the mind suffers more often in imagination than in reality, and bargaining is imagination. It's you rehearsing discomfort before it even arrives, as if the anticipation is the task. So the practical move is to shorten the distance between decision and action, because the longer that distance is, the more room your mind has to talk you out of it. If you decide you're going to do the task, then the next step should be physical and immediate. Open the document, put on the shoes, set the timer, step outside, sit down at the desk. Not because that's magic, but because starting is the lever. Once the lever moves, the rest of you often follows. And even when it doesn't, you've still trained the most important muscle, the ability to begin. And something else happens when you build this quietly. You start trusting yourself again. Self-trust is not a motivational quote. It's a byproduct of small promises kept. If you only make big promises, you'll break many of them, and every broken promise is a tiny crack in your self-respect. But if you make small promises and keep them consistently, you rebuild that respect in a way that doesn't require hype. You begin to feel stable inside, and stability is what makes discipline feel natural instead of forced. Marcus Aurelius didn't need to be watched to do what was right. His standard lived inside him. That is what you're building here, an internal standard that doesn't need applause. And that's why silence helps so much, because silence removes the temptation to perform consistency for other people, and it leaves you alone with the only thing that counts, what you actually do. So, if you want a clean way to apply this today, choose one small promise that is slightly uncomfortable but easy to verify, and keep it without announcing it. Let it be private, almost boring, because boring is sustainable. Then, when you slip, as everyone slips, practice the stoic skill of quick correction without self-attack. Don't turn one miss into a story about your identity. Treat it like a simple drift and return to center the next day without drama. Here's the if-then that makes this real. If you catch yourself negotiating, then begin the smallest entry point of the task within 10 seconds, before your mind can build a courtroom around it. Start first, think later. And when you finish, whether it's a full session or just a meaningful start, don't rush to talk about it. Let the proof sit inside you. That quiet proof is what strengthens discipline over time, without you needing to feel like it every day. And once your discipline starts to feel like a standard instead of a struggle, your presence changes in a way people can sense, and your words, because they're fewer, start carrying weight without you trying, which is where we go next. 3. People start taking you seriously faster. Have you ever said something you genuinely meant, something important, something thoughtful, and still felt it land flat, like the room heard you but didn't register you, as if your words were just another drop in a constant stream? A lot of people interpret that as, they don't respect me, but often it's simpler than that. You've trained people to hear you as background noise. When your life is filled with constant explaining, constant updates, constant commentary, your voice becomes familiar in the wrong way. Predictable, available, always on. And when something is always on, it loses impact, not because it isn't valuable, but because it isn't scarce. The Stoics understood something that modern life tries to hide. Attention is a currency, and scarcity creates value. Seneca spoke about how easily we waste ourselves, our hours, our focus, our dignity, by scattering them. Words can be scattered too. And when they are, even sincere words start feeling cheap because they arrive in the same flood as everything else. But when you speak less, something changes almost immediately, and it's not manipulation, it's human nature. People lean in, they listen harder, they start reading your presence instead of waiting for your explanation. Your silence creates a small tension. Not a hostile tension, but a focused one. And in that focused space, your words begin to carry weight without you pushing them. This is one of the hidden benefits of keeping your mouth shut. You stop flooding the room and your voice becomes a signal again. Marcus Aurelius, as an emperor surrounded by people who talked for a living, would have seen this constantly. Advisors, flatterers, critics, complainers, endless language, endless noise. Yet in his private writing you can feel how much he respected restraint, not as a posture, but as a form of self-governance. The person who can remain steady and measured in a world addicted to reaction becomes rare, and rarity is what people instinctively respect. And it's not only about frequency of speech, it's also about what your speech is trying to do. Over-explaining usually carries a hidden message, please approve my choice. Even if you don't intend it, that's what it trains people to feel. The more you justify yourself, the more you make your decisions sound negotiable. The more you clarify, the more you invite debate. The more you argue your side, the more you place your peace in other people's hands, because now your calm depends on whether they accept your reasoning. Epictetus would call that a mistake of control. You're trying to control the wrong thing. You can control your actions, your standards, your boundaries. You can't control whether others understand them on the first try. And the more you chase understanding, the more you look uncertain, even when you're right. Because certainty doesn't beg. So the shift here is simple. Let your actions create credibility, and let your words become an extension of that credibility, not a substitute for it. When you're consistent privately, you stop needing to sell yourself publicly. That's why people take you seriously faster. They feel the difference. You're not asking to be taken seriously. You're behaving like someone who already has a standard. Now, this changes the way you move through daily conversations. Instead of reacting quickly, you pause. Instead of filling silence, you let it sit. Instead of answering every question immediately, you choose what you answer and how much you reveal. Instead of explaining your decisions, you state them cleanly and move forward. And that calm restraint does something powerful. It forces the other person to deal with your reality, not your performance. Because here's the uncomfortable truth. Some people don't take you seriously because you've made it easy for them not to. You answer everything. You defend everything. You give them too much access to your uncertainty. You show them your emotional map before they've earned it. And once they have your map, they can push buttons, start debates, pull you into proving yourself. When you stop doing that, the dynamic shifts. Your words become fewer, so they're noticed. Your answers become cleaner, so they're respected. Your presence becomes steadier, so it's trusted. And trust is what seriousness is built on. People take you seriously when they sense you take yourself seriously. And self-seriousness doesn't mean arrogance. It means you don't live like your life is a public argument. Seneca would say that dignity is not something you demand, it's something you protect. And the easiest way to protect dignity is to stop pouring it into conversations that don't deserve it. So how do you apply this without becoming cold or distant? You don't need to become silent with everyone, you become selective. There's a difference between privacy and isolation, between restraint and hostility. The goal isn't to starve your relationships. The goal is to remove unnecessary speech, the kind that is really anxiety, the kind that is really people-pleasing, the kind that is really a search for validation. Here's a simple test you can run in real time. Before you speak, ask yourself, am I adding value or am I trying to be understood? If it's value, say it. If it's validation, pause. If it's fear, pause longer. And notice what happens. You'll start hearing other people more clearly. You'll start catching the subtle games. How some people ask questions not to learn, but to pull you into explaining. You'll start sensing who respects silence and who panics in it. and that information helps you choose your words with precision. Here's the if-then that makes this lesson concrete. If you feel yourself over-explaining, then cut your sentence in half and let the rest be silence. State your point cleanly, then stop. Don't chase approval. Don't fill the gap. Let your calm carry the message. Because the more you practice this, the more your life begins to feel different. You stop sounding like someone asking to be respected, and you start sounding like someone who already respects himself. And once that happens, conversations stop being something you survive, and they become something you can navigate with quiet power. Which is exactly where we go next, because when you speak less, you begin to see more, and what you see gives you leverage. 4. Your social power increases in every conversation. Have you ever walked away from a conversation feeling slightly exposed, not because you confessed something dramatic, but because you could sense you revealed your inner temperature, what irritates you, what you crave, what you're trying to prove, what you're afraid of, and then you realize the other person left with more information about you than you have about them? That's the quiet way social power gets lost. Not through one obvious mistake, but through a habit of constant disclosure, where you treat conversation like a place to empty your mind instead of a place to choose your words. Most people think influence comes from being impressive, quick, and dominant, but the Stoic view is calmer and more precise. Influence begins with self-command, because if you can't command your own reactions, someone else eventually will. Epictetus built his entire teaching around a simple division, what is up to you and what is not. And in conversation, that division is everything. What's up to you is your judgment, your tone, your timing, your restraint, your choice to speak or not speak. What's not up to you is the other person's interpretation, their mood, their hidden agenda, and their desire to pull you into their frame. The moment you start chasing control over their interpretation, you begin giving away control over your own state, because now you're speaking to manage their feelings instead of speaking from principle. And here's the uncomfortable truth that most people never learn. The person who speaks more usually reveals more, and the person who reveals more becomes easier to steer. It's not always malicious. It's just how humans work. When you talk a lot, you unintentionally hand out your emotional map. What triggers you, what you want badly, what embarrasses you, what you need approval for. And once your map is visible, you become predictable. And predictability is the doorway to manipulation, whether that manipulation is obvious and cruel or subtle and ordinary, like someone knowing exactly how to guilt you, flatter you, pressure you, or bait you into defending yourself. Marcus Aurelius would have seen this clearly. An emperor lives in a world of performance, persuasion, flattery, and quiet competition. And if he responded to every provocation, every opinion, every shifting alliance, he would have been a puppet. So you can feel in his private writing a man trying to remain unhooked, trying to keep his inner state from being owned by the room, reminding himself again and again to meet people with steadiness, not with reflex. That is the root of social power. Not that you dominate the conversation, but that the conversation doesn't dominate you. This is why strategic silence changes your position without you trying to play games. When you speak less, you create space, and in that space, other people reveal themselves. You start noticing what they repeat, where they get emotional, what they avoid, what they exaggerate, what they're fishing for. You begin to hear the frame behind the words. Are they trying to connect or to control? To understand or to be right? To help or to pull you into a story where you owe them something? When you listen with that kind of attention, conversations stop being exhausting because you're no longer reacting to the surface. You're reading the structure underneath it. And this becomes practical in everyday moments. someone tries to pull you into gossip, and instead of joining, you stay neutral and short, and suddenly you can see who they are when you don't feed them. Someone challenges your decision with a "why would you do that?" and you answer cleanly without building a courtroom around your choice. And the moment you stop over-defending, you find out whether they were truly curious or quietly trying to manage you. Someone throws a comment designed to provoke your ego, and you don't rush to correct the narrative. And what you gain is not only peace, but information. You learn who needs you reactive so they can feel powerful. Seneca warned that we lose ourselves by scattering ourselves, and one of the easiest ways to scatter yourself is to keep giving people your emotional energy in the form of unnecessary words. When you stop donating that energy, you become harder to pull into pointless debates, harder to trap in endless explanation, harder to bait into reactions that you later pay for. Your social power rises because your internal stability rises, and internal stability is felt by others, even when you say nothing at all. So you don't need to act mysterious, and you don't need to become distant. You simply need to become intentional. You can be warm and still be selective. You can be kind and still be quiet. You can be present and still keep your inner world protected until trust is earned. This is not secrecy, it's discernment, and discernment is one of the most underrated forms of strength. Here's the if-then that makes it real. If you feel the urge to fill a silence or over-explain in order to reduce your own discomfort, then pause and ask one simple question instead, or let the space remain, because silence forces clarity. It forces the other person to show their intention. It forces you to stay anchored. And over time, that habit alone will change your social life, because people learn quickly who can be pushed and who can't. And once you stop being pushed so easily, your plans become harder to sabotage because fewer people can touch your direction, fewer opinions can contaminate your momentum, and your life becomes simpler to execute. Quietly, steadily, and on your terms. 5. Your plans become harder to sabotage. Have you ever shared a plan you were excited about and within a day or two, you felt strangely contaminated by other people's reactions, like their questions added pressure, their opinions added confusion, their doubts added weight, and suddenly what felt simple in your mind started feeling complicated? That's not imagination. That's what happens when a plan becomes public too early. It stops being yours alone, and it becomes a social object. It becomes something people can touch, evaluate, interpret, compare, and reshape. And even if nobody is trying to harm you, the plan still becomes vulnerable, because the moment it's outside of you, it's exposed to noise. And noise is one of the most common ways good intentions die. Stoicism teaches you to protect what is in your control, and one of the most overlooked parts of control is protecting the conditions that allow your best actions to happen. Epictetus would tell you to focus on what depends on you, and your execution depends on something most people ignore: clean attention. Clean attention is fragile. It doesn't survive constant commentary. It doesn't survive being pulled into debates. It doesn't survive trying to keep up with expectations you didn't even agree to. This is why silence is not just a personal style choice. It's mission security. Because the moment your plan becomes public, it becomes surrounded by other people's needs. Some people will discourage you, not because they hate you, but because your plan threatens their comfort. It reminds them of what they aren't doing. It brings out their fears, and they project those fears onto you as advice. They'll say things like, "Be careful, that's risky, don't get your hopes up," and it sounds caring, but often it's just their nervous system trying to lower the emotional temperature of the room by lowering your ambition. Other people will support you loudly, and that can be just as dangerous. Not because support is bad, but because once people are invested in your plan, they start expecting updates, expecting visible progress, expecting you to stay consistent in public. And then the plan becomes performance again. You stop doing it for yourself and start doing it to maintain an image. That turns execution into stress, and stress slows you down. And then there's the third kind of interference, the most common one, entropy. The casual opinions, the random suggestions, the have you tried this from 10 different directions. None of it is evil. But it breaks your focus into pieces, and a plan with broken focus becomes a plan with broken momentum. Seneca had a deep awareness of this, even if he didn't talk in modern terms. He warned that we suffer because we allow too many external forces to enter our minds, and when too many forces enter, we lose the simple ability to carry out what we intended. In a practical sense, that means if too many people have access to your plan, too many people have influence over your emotional state while you're trying to execute it. So the goal is not to hide because you're afraid. The goal is to protect because you're serious. A plan is not fragile because it's weak. It's fragile because it's early, like a flame in wind. It doesn't need a speech. It needs shelter. It needs time. It needs repetition. It needs quiet. And silence gives it exactly that. When you keep your plan private, you remove a huge category of friction. You don't have to manage people's expectations. You don't have to answer their questions. You don't have to defend your timeline. You don't have to debate your reasoning. You don't have to fight their doubt. And you don't have to carry their excitement either. You just do the work. And work thrives in clean conditions. Marcus Aurelius would call this returning to your task. Again and again, no theater, no commentary. He understood that the mind has a limited amount of attention, and if you waste it on what people think, you have less for what you need to do. When you make the mission quiet, you keep the mission clean. Now, how do you actually apply this without turning into someone who never shares anything? You create timing and permission. Timing means you don't share the plan during its most vulnerable stage. You share after you've built momentum, after it's no longer depending on emotional excitement, after it has become routine. You share when it's stable enough that opinions won't sway it. Permission means you decide who gets access. Not based on who is curious, but based on who is constructive. Some people add clarity and calm. Some people add noise and doubt. The difference is usually visible if you pay attention to how you feel after you talk to them. If you feel grounded, they're safe. If you feel scattered, they're not. And there's a deeper layer. When you keep plans private, execution speeds up. Because the plan becomes simpler. It becomes a straight line between you and the work. No detours through other people's minds. This is where a lot of sabotage actually comes from. It's not someone actively trying to stop you. It's the fact that you gave your plan too many entrances, too many doors where opinions can walk in. Every door is a delay. Every door is a possible doubt. Every door is a potential argument. Silence closes those doors until you've built something real. So here's the if-then for this lesson. If you feel excited about a new plan and you want to tell someone, then pause and ask, will this person make execution easier or will they make it louder? If the answer is louder, keep it to yourself and do one concrete step instead. Protect the flame. And over time, you'll notice a quiet shift. You'll begin to enjoy building without witnesses. You'll begin to feel a private momentum that doesn't need applause. You'll begin to trust yourself more because your progress is no longer a public performance. And then something else becomes easier too. Your emotions stop running your decisions because you've created space between stimulus and response. And that space is where dignity lives. That's the next lesson. 6. Your emotions stop running your decisions. Have you ever sent a message you regretted almost immediately, or said something in a heated moment that you couldn't take back, and then later, when you were calm, you looked at yourself like, why did I do that? As if a different person borrowed your mouth for a minute. Most damage in life isn't planned, it's impulsive. It happens in the first reply, the first defensive explanation, the first sarcastic line, the first angry paragraph, the first "let me show you" reaction. And it's rarely the big events that ruin your peace. It's the small moments where emotion takes the steering wheel and drives your future into a wall. Stoicism is almost obsessively focused on this exact problem, because the Stoics understood that the mind doesn't break from one catastrophe, it breaks from repeated loss of self-command. Epictetus taught that you cannot control what happens outside you, but you can control your judgment about it, and that judgment is the gate between stimulus and response. Marcus Aurelius would remind himself that the event is one thing, and your story about it is another, and that most suffering comes from confusing the two. In simple terms, the world pushes a button, and your mind decides whether that button turns into chaos or clarity. Silence is what builds that decision point, because silence creates a pause, and the pause protects you from regret. When you keep your mouth shut at the wrong moment, when you're flooded, triggered, embarrassed, angry, you aren't being passive, you're being strategic. You're refusing to let temporary emotion create permanent consequences. You're choosing to delay the response until your higher mind is back online. That sounds simple, but it's a life-changing skill, because most people respond to emotion with more emotion, and then they call the outcome life. They call it relationships. They call it communication. But really, it's just reactivity. So the first thing this lesson teaches you is to stop answering while emotional, not stop feeling. Feeling is human. The Stoics weren't trying to become stone. They were trying to become sovereign. They were trying to feel without being controlled. Now, here's the part most people don't notice. Over-explaining is often emotional. It looks rational, but it's driven by fear. Fear of being misunderstood, fear of losing status, fear of being judged. And the more emotional you are, the more you explain, because your nervous system is trying to regain safety by gaining agreement. You want the other person to say, "Okay, I get it," because that would calm the discomfort. But if you train yourself to seek calm through agreement, you'll always be anxious, because agreement is not in your control. Epictetus would call that attaching your peace to what isn't yours. So the quiet discipline here is to stop using words as emotional medication. Instead, you practice letting the emotion rise and fall without acting on it immediately. Because emotion is like weather. It changes, but if you make decisions in the storm, you often build a life you later have to repair. Marcus Aurelius would tell himself in different ways to wait, to step back, to see the situation clearly, to remember that most people act out of their own confusion, and to not let another person's chaos become his. That is not weakness. That is leadership, starting with leading your own mind. Now, what does this look like in daily life? It looks like receiving a provocative message and not responding right away, even if you could, even if you want to. You read it, you feel the heat, and instead of letting your thumbs start a war, you step away. You give yourself time to become wise again. It looks like being challenged in a conversation and not defending your entire identity in one breath. You don't rush to clear it up. You don't dump explanations. You let a misunderstanding sit for a moment. You choose a short response or no response until you're calm. It looks like someone trying to bait you with sarcasm and you refusing the bait, not because you're afraid, but because you understand the price. The price is your peace. The price is your dignity. The price is the next 2 hours of your mind replaying the conversation. Seneca would call it the cost of anger. The consequences are heavier than the causes. The cause might be a small insult, a small disrespect, a small irritation. The consequence might be a damaged relationship, a ruined night, a reputation hit, a decision made in rage, a regret that follows you for weeks. So you stop paying that cost. And the way you stop paying is by building a pause that becomes automatic. This is why silence changes your life. It turns reaction into response. And response is where your future is protected. Now, there's a deeper reason this lesson matters. When you stop reacting emotionally, you stop being easily controlled. A person who can provoke you can steer you. A person who can make you defensive can make you explain. A person who can make you angry can make you impulsive. But when you can hold your silence under pressure, you become hard to manipulate. That's not about power over others. That's about power over yourself, which is the only power that actually lasts. So here's the if-then for this lesson. If you feel emotionally activated, angry, embarrassed, insulted, anxious, then delay your response. Give yourself a rule that you respect, like a law. I don't reply at peak emotion. Step away, breathe, walk, drink water, sleep on it if you can. Then return when your mind is clear enough to choose words you'll respect tomorrow. And when you return, speak from principle, not from heat. Keep it clean, keep it simple, keep it controlled. Because every time you do that, you build self-respect in the most real way. You prove to yourself that your emotions are allowed to exist, but they are not allowed to govern you. And once you become someone who doesn't negotiate with emotion, your boundaries become effortless because you stop explaining your standards like you're asking permission. You simply live them. That's the next lesson. 7. Your boundaries become effortless. Have you ever noticed that the people who struggle most with boundaries are usually the ones who try to explain them the most, as if the boundary won't be real unless the other person agrees with it, understands it, approves of it, and signs off on it emotionally? That's the trap, because the moment your boundary becomes an explanation, it becomes a negotiation. And the moment it becomes a negotiation, you've taught the other person that persistence is a strategy that works on you. Which means the next time they want something you don't want to give, they won't respect your no, they'll simply wait for the part where you start defending it. Then they'll attack the defense, not the decision. And suddenly, your peace is on trial. The Stoics had a cleaner standard. Your life is yours to govern, and governance doesn't require applause. Epictetus is relentless on this point. If something is not up to you, stop trying to manage it. So if someone dislikes your boundary, misunderstands your boundary, or tries to punish you for your boundary, that reaction is not your job to control. And the moment you chase their approval, you hand them the steering wheel, because now your no depends on their mood, which is exactly how boundaries collapse. This is where keeping your mouth shut becomes a form of strength, because over-explaining is often a hidden request to be liked. And a boundary that depends on being liked is not a boundary, it's a hope. You can feel the difference in your body. When you're explaining too much, there's tension, urgency, a need to convince, and that urgency tells the other person you're not fully anchored, which invites them to push again, not necessarily out of malice, but because people naturally test what feels uncertain. Marcus Aurelius would tell himself to do what is right without turning it into theater, and that's the same skill here. You don't need a speech. You need a standard that you keep consistently, because consistency is what trains the world how to treat you. Effortless boundaries are not loud, and they're not dramatic, and they're not emotional, because the strongest boundary isn't the one you deliver with intensity, it's the one you keep when nobody claps for it. Especially when the other person acts confused, disappointed, or offended. When you stop feeding the conversation with extra words, something surprising happens. People either adjust, or they reveal that they never respected you in the first place. And either outcome is a gift, because adjustment creates peace, and revelation creates clarity. And clarity is always better than living inside constant emotional bargaining. Think about how many boundaries you've tried to enforce with paragraphs, with long explanations, with reasons stacked on reasons, and how often that turned into more debate, more defensiveness, and more exhaustion, because you weren't just setting a boundary, you were also trying to protect the other person from feeling discomfort, and that second job is what drains you. Seneca warned that we often suffer not from what we must do, but from what we add to it. And in boundary setting, we add something heavy. We add the responsibility of managing other people's emotions, which is impossible. And the moment you accept it as your role, you'll keep sacrificing your time, your attention, and your dignity trying to do an undoable thing. So the practical shift is to make boundaries simple, brief, and repeatable, the way a rule is repeatable. Because a rule that requires a new explanation each time is not really a rule, it's a performance. You don't need to sound harsh, you just need to sound settled. And settled doesn't mean cold, it means clear. It's saying, I'm not available for that, and then letting silence do its work, even if the other person fills the space with guilt, curiosity, sarcasm, or pressure, because silence is the part that proves you meant what you said. This is also where your life becomes lighter, because once you stop negotiating your standards, you stop reliving the same conversations with different faces. You stop having to justify why you need time. You stop having to defend why you're focused. You stop having to explain why you're not interested in drama. You stop having to plead for respect. You simply choose, and then you return to your mission, and that return is the real boundary. Because it shows that your life is not available to be endlessly redirected. If you want to apply this immediately, there's a simple if-then that rewires the habit. If you notice yourself explaining past the first clear sentence, then stop and replace the extra words with a calm repeat of the boundary. Because repetition is stronger than justification. The first time you state it, it's information. The second time you repeat it without emotion, it becomes a wall. And when you can repeat it with the same calm tone, you teach people that pushing won't change the outcome, so they either respect it or they move on to someone they can negotiate with. And the deeper reward, the one that changes your internal world, is that you start trusting yourself, because nothing builds self-respect faster than watching yourself hold the line without needing to be understood first. You don't become rigid, you become stable, and stability is what makes your relationships healthier, because people know where you stand, and they stop trying to read you through your anxiety. Once boundaries become effortless, the entire social world becomes quieter because you're no longer maintaining conflicts that never needed to exist in the first place, and you begin recovering a kind of mental energy. Most people don't even realize they've been spending every day, energy that can finally go back into your work, your health, your craft, and your peace, which leads directly into the next lesson. When your life gets quieter, your mind gets clearer. 8. Your life gets quieter, so your mind gets clearer. Have you ever had a day where nothing big happened, but you still felt completely drained, like your mind had been running in the background the entire time, carrying conversations you didn't even want to have, rehearsing explanations you never gave, replaying moments you can't change, trying to manage how you were perceived by people who won't remember the interaction next week? That kind of exhaustion isn't always work. Often it's social maintenance, the hidden labor of keeping the world comfortable around you, smoothing things over, responding fast enough, staying available enough, clarifying enough, proving you meant well enough. And when you do that long enough, your mind begins to feel crowded, not because life is complicated, but because you're living with too many open loops. Silence closes loops. Not in a dramatic way, but in a practical way. When you stop narrating yourself, you stop feeding unnecessary interactions. When you stop explaining your choices, you stop inviting debate. When you stop reacting to every comment, you stop creating new conflicts. When you stop giving quick access to your emotional world, you stop being pulled into other people's moods. And as those small choices stack up, your life becomes quieter almost by default because you're no longer constantly handling people. The Stoics would recognize this immediately as a kind of return to what matters. Seneca wrote with real urgency about how easily we waste our time, and he wasn't only talking about hours in the obvious sense. He was talking about the way we donate our attention to things that don't deserve it, then wonder why our inner life feels thin and tired. Epictetus would describe this as misplaced concern, worrying about what isn't yours to control. Because every time you invest energy trying to manage someone's opinion of you, you've moved away from the only territory you can actually govern. And that's why quiet creates clarity. It brings your attention back home. Clarity is not some special intelligence. It's what happens when your mind is no longer being interrupted. Think about it. The brain can hold only so much at once. If part of your attention is always tracking messages, tracking social pressure, tracking what you should say next, tracking what you might have said wrong, tracking whether someone is upset, tracking whether you're being judged, then even if you're technically free, you're not mentally free. You're carrying invisible conversations like weight in your pockets. So the first thing silence gives you is mental space. And mental space is where good decisions are made. Marcus Aurelius understood this deeply because he lived in a world where noise wasn't optional. Politics, conflict, responsibility, constant demands. Yet his private practice was to return to stillness inside himself, to clear perception, to a calm mind that could see what was essential and let the rest fall away. The Stoic move is not to remove every disturbance from life. It's to remove unnecessary disturbance from the mind. And a surprising amount of disturbance is self-inflicted. It comes from responding too quickly. It comes from explaining too much. It comes from trying to be understood by everyone. It comes from staying in conversations that have already crossed the line into disrespect or pointless debate. It comes from maintaining relationships that exist mostly out of habit, guilt, or fear of what will happen if you stop being available. When you start keeping your mouth shut in the right moments, many of those disturbances fade because they were being fed by your participation. The moment you stop feeding them, they lose energy. That's not cruelty, that's reality. Many problems only survive because you keep giving them your attention. Now, when your life gets quieter, the mind does something very interesting. It begins to reveal what it actually cares about. Under all the noise, there's usually a simple truth that you've been too distracted to hear. Sometimes, it's that your work matters to you more than you admitted. Sometimes, it's that certain friendships are draining you. Sometimes, it's that you've been avoiding a decision because you didn't want the discomfort of someone's reaction. Sometimes, it's that your routine is chaotic and you've been using social noise as an excuse to not face your own lack of structure. Quiet makes these truths visible, and that visibility is clarity. There's also a second layer. When you reduce social noise, your emotional life stabilizes because emotions are contagious. You enter conversations and absorb other people's anxiety, other people's anger, other people's insecurity. And if you're always online, always available, always engaged, you'll feel like your emotions are unpredictable when in fact you're just constantly exposed to emotional weather. Stoicism teaches emotional hygiene, not by suppression, but by selectivity. You don't let your mind be an open door. You don't let every voice move you. You decide what enters. This is why quiet isn't empty. It's protective. It's the space where your judgment becomes sharper, where your priorities become simpler, where your attention stops being chopped into pieces. So how do you apply this lesson without turning your life into isolation? You don't need to remove people. You remove unnecessary access. You stop answering immediately. You stop attending every debate. You stop volunteering personal information that turns into discussion. You stop keeping relationships alive through constant messaging when there's no real depth. You stop maintaining misunderstandings with endless clarification. And you replace that with a simpler rule. You respond when you're calm and when it's purposeful. Here's the if. Then, if an interaction consistently leaves you scattered, irritated, or exhausted, then reduce your participation in it, not with hostility, but with distance, because you're protecting clarity. And clarity is what allows you to build anything meaningful. That might mean fewer messages, shorter answers, fewer visits, fewer explanations, fewer late-night conversations that go nowhere. When you do this, you'll notice your mind becoming clearer in a practical way. You'll think better, you'll sleep better, you'll choose better, you'll feel less pulled, you'll stop making decisions just to end pressure. You'll start making decisions based on what you actually value. And once your mind becomes clearer, something else happens almost automatically. Your reputation begins to improve without you trying, because you stop promising, you stop talking, and you start delivering. That's the next lesson. 9. Your reputation improves without you trying. Have you ever met someone who didn't talk much about what they were doing, didn't explain themselves constantly, didn't promise the world, and yet you somehow trusted them more than the loud people, even if you couldn't immediately explain why? That reaction in you is not random. It's your mind responding to a rare signal, consistency without performance. Most reputations aren't ruined by one big scandal. They're weakened by a pattern of small mismatches. Too many promises that don't land. Too many claims that aren't backed by action. Too many dramatic statements that fade into nothing. People can forgive a mistake, but they struggle to trust a pattern of unreliability. And the truth is that a lot of unreliability isn't intentional. It's created by speech, by speaking too early, by promising too easily, by narrating progress instead of making progress. Silence fixes this in a very practical way. When you talk less, you promise less. When you promise less, you break fewer promises. When you break fewer promises, your name starts carrying something most people don't have: quiet reliability. Seneca would recognize this as a form of dignity. Dignity is not what you claim. It's what your behavior proves over time. And when your behavior proves something consistently, people don't need you to advertise it. They feel it. They begin expecting you to do what you said, because you've trained them through evidence, not persuasion. Epictetus would take it even deeper and say that your reputation is not fully in your control, but your character is, and character is the thing that creates reputation as a byproduct. The paradox is that the more you chase reputation with words, the more fragile it becomes, because now your reputation depends on convincing people, and convincing people requires constant effort, constant explaining, constant impression management. But when you focus on character, when you focus on actions you can repeat, reputation becomes almost automatic, because people observe patterns even when you think they aren't watching. And here's the part that matters. When you speak less, you become more accurate. You stop making dramatic statements you can't maintain. You stop telling people, "I'll do it," when you're not sure you will. You stop trying to sound ambitious in conversation. You stop making emotional promises in emotional moments. You become careful with your words, not out of fear, but out of respect for your own integrity. And that care changes how people relate to you. Because most people have been trained to treat words like cheap currency. They hear big talk all the time. They hear enthusiasm that disappears. They hear promises that are more like wishes. They hear, "I'm going to," and "I will," and "I'm starting," and "I'm changing," and then nothing happens. So when they meet someone who doesn't do that, someone who speaks with restraint, someone who doesn't overcommit, someone who doesn't narrate their future, they sense stability. They sense seriousness. They sense a person who isn't trying to win attention with intention. Marcus Aurelius would call this living according to your principles without needing witnesses. His private writing shows a man who was constantly trying to close the gap between what he valued and what he did. And that is the essence of trustworthiness. Trustworthiness is not charisma, it's alignment. Now, it's important to say this clearly. This lesson isn't about becoming silent so people admire you. That would just be another performance. This is about removing the habits that damage trust without you noticing. For example, a lot of people unintentionally train others not to take them seriously because they speak in exaggerated commitments. I'm going to change my whole life. This year will be different. I'm locked in. I'll never do that again. Those sentences feel powerful when you say them, but unless your actions match them, they quietly weaken your credibility. You don't even need someone to call you out. Your own mind hears the mismatch too, and over time, that mismatch lowers self-respect, which makes it harder to keep promises, which then lowers credibility even more. Silence breaks the cycle, because silence encourages smaller, truer commitments, and smaller, truer commitments are the fastest way to build a strong name. So what does this look like in real life? It looks like being the person who shows up when they say they will, without announcing they're reliable. It looks like doing the work and letting the results speak, instead of posting the intention. It looks like giving fewer explanations and making fewer excuses because you've reduced the number of promises that require explaining. It looks like under-promising and over-delivering, not as a tactic, but as a natural byproduct of speaking more carefully. And this changes the social atmosphere around you. People stop pressing you for proof because you have a history of proof. People stop doubting your follow-through because they've seen you follow through. People stop treating your words like entertainment because your words are tied to action. That is the quiet upgrade in reputation. Now, the deeper part of this lesson is internal. Your reputation with yourself improves too, because every time you say less and do more, you start trusting your own mind again. You stop feeling like you're living in potential and start feeling like you're living in reality. That internal trust is what makes external trust easier. People pick up on it. They feel the steadiness. So here's the if-then that makes this actionable. If you feel the urge to promise something big, then commit to one small, verifiable action instead, and let the promise be silent. Let your calendar, your routine, and your output carry the message. Over time, your name will start carrying weight without you trying to add weight to it. And once your name carries weight, your confidence changes too, because it's no longer confidence that depends on being seen. It becomes confidence that comes from private integrity. That's the next lesson. 10. Your confidence becomes real instead of performative. Have you ever felt confident in a moment when people were watching you, when the energy was high, when you were being noticed? And then later, alone, in the quiet, felt that confidence drain away, as if it belonged to the room more than it belonged to you. That's one of the most common forms of confidence in the modern world, confidence that needs witnesses. It's not fake in the sense that you're lying, but it's unstable because it's built on reaction. It rises when you feel approved of and falls when you feel invisible, which means your self-esteem becomes a weather report based on other people's attention. Stoicism aims at something very different. The Stoics weren't trying to feel good all the time. They were trying to be solid. They wanted a confidence that remains when nobody is clapping, a confidence that survives misunderstanding, a confidence that doesn't collapse when you don't get a reply, a like, a compliment, or a sign that the world is impressed. Epictetus would say that if your peace depends on what other people do, then your peace is not yours. And confidence is part of peace. If it's dependent, it's not really confidence, it's a fragile arrangement with the crowd. This is where keeping your mouth shut becomes a surprisingly direct path to real confidence, because silence removes the easiest way to borrow confidence, being witnessed. When you stop updating people, you stop using their reactions as emotional fuel. When you stop announcing progress, you stop using applause as proof. When you stop explaining yourself, you stop trying to earn calm through agreement. And at first, that can feel like losing something because you're removing a familiar source of reassurance. But what replaces it is stronger. What replaces it is private integrity. Private integrity is when you do what you said you would do, even when nobody will ever know about it. It's when you keep a promise that produces no immediate social reward. It's when you take the hard walk, do the boring work, refuse the temptation, hold the boundary, return to the discipline, not because it looks good, but because it is right for you. That is the root of real confidence, the sense that you can rely on yourself. Marcus Aurelius built his mind around this. His private writing is filled with reminders that are almost painfully practical. Do your duty, be honest with yourself, don't act for praise, don't waste your time, don't let comfort rule you. He wasn't trying to build a public image, he was trying to remain worthy of his own respect. And once you become worthy of your own respect, confidence stops being a performance and starts being an inner fact. Seneca would add something important here. Much of what people call confidence is really just distraction. It's a high, it's a social rush, it's the temporary excitement of being noticed. And the reason it disappears when you're alone is because it was never rooted in your character, it was rooted in stimulation. So when the stimulation is gone, the feeling goes with it. Silence removes stimulation, which means silence forces truth. And truth is where confidence becomes real. Now, this lesson can be uncomfortable because it asks you to face a hard question. When you do things, how much of it is for your own growth? And how much of it is to be seen as someone who is growing? That question is not meant to shame you. It's meant to free you, because the moment you see how often you've been seeking to be witnessed, you can stop. And once you stop, you recover your energy. You stop building a life that depends on attention. You start building a life that produces attention naturally if it ever comes, but doesn't need it to function. And the practical result is that you become calmer in social settings too. You don't chase validation in conversation. You don't need to prove your value. You don't rush to mention what you're doing, who you know, what you've achieved, what you plan to achieve. You're not hiding, you're simply not advertising. You don't need the room to agree with you for you to remain steady. That steadiness is felt by others, but more importantly, it's felt by you. Because your confidence becomes portable, it works in public and in private. It stays with you in quiet mornings and lonely evenings. It stays with you when plans are uncertain. It stays with you when people misunderstand you. It stays with you when nothing is happening externally, because it's being powered internally. So what does real confidence look like in daily life? It looks like not explaining a boundary and not feeling guilty afterward. It looks like doing the work you said you'd do and not telling anyone. It looks like walking away from drama without needing the last word. It looks like saying no without a paragraph. It looks like being alone and still feeling steady, because your identity isn't borrowed from the crowd. And this is why silence is so powerful here. It turns your life into a private contract you keep, and every time you keep it, you build evidence inside yourself that you are trustworthy. That evidence becomes self-respect, and self-respect becomes confidence. Here's the if-then for this lesson. If you feel the urge to announce what you're doing in order to feel real, then do one hard, quiet action instead and let it be enough. Let the action be the proof. Let the proof be yours. Over time, you won't need the audience to feel strong, because strength will become something you can feel in your own chest, even in silence. And once confidence becomes real, the next shift is profound. You become harder to hurt, because you stop giving people easy access to your inner world, and your peace stops being a public space. 11. You become harder to hurt. Have you ever opened up to someone, not even dramatically, just enough to feel connected, and then later, maybe in an argument, maybe in a casual joke, maybe in a moment where they wanted leverage, you heard your own private truth come back at you like a weapon. That experience changes people. It makes them either close completely, or it makes them keep oversharing while quietly resenting the consequences. But there's a third path, and it's the stoic path. Privacy without bitterness, restraint without fear, openness with discernment. And that path begins with one idea most people never learn. Your inner world should not be public property. Because the more you give people access to what hurts you, what you fear, what you crave, what you regret, the more power you hand them over your mood. Not because everyone is malicious, but because human beings, especially when they're emotional, use what they know. They reach for pressure points. They reach for shortcuts. They reach for the thing that works. And if you've made your pressure points obvious, life becomes louder, messier, more reactive. The Stoics would call this an issue of control, but in a very specific way. Epictetus taught that your freedom depends on what you allow to disturb you, and that disturbance often enters through impressions, through the stories you tell yourself about what someone said, what they meant, what it implies about you. When you overshare, you create more openings for disturbance, because now more people can poke at your identity, and your identity becomes fragile because it's been handed out in pieces. Silence reduces openings. It doesn't make you numb, it makes you protected. And protection is not weakness. Protection is wisdom. Marcus Aurelius lived under constant judgment. People would have been watching him, criticizing him, praising him, twisting his words, interpreting his motives. If he had made his peace dependent on being understood, he would have been miserable. Instead, you can feel him training his mind to become less penetrable, to not let insults define him, to not let praise inflate him, to return to his own standards. That's what harder to hurt really means. It means your emotional stability is less available to other people's hands. Now, there's a common misunderstanding here. Some people think being harder to hurt means becoming cold, detached, unreachable, but that's not strength, that's armor that cuts you too. Stoicism doesn't ask you to stop caring. It asks you to stop bleeding in public. It asks you to stop making your healing dependent on other people's reactions. Because oversharing often happens for one reason. You want relief. You want someone to tell you it's okay. You want the discomfort to leave your chest. You want to be seen. And that's human. But if relief becomes the goal, you'll keep paying for it with vulnerability you didn't mean to give. The smarter move is to choose where you are vulnerable. Discernment means you don't share everything with everyone. You don't speak from the wound while it's still open. You don't reveal your fears to people who enjoy drama. You don't confess your insecurities to people who compete with you. You don't hand your private story to someone who hasn't proven they can hold it with respect. Seneca warned about keeping the wrong company, and not in a snobbish way, more in a practical way. He understood that people shape you. Their values enter your mind. Their habits influence your habits. Their instability invites your instability. So being harder to hurt begins with noticing the environments and the relationships where you consistently feel exposed, drained, or emotionally unsafe. And then you adjust, not with hostility, with distance. You also begin to practice a new rule. Not everything you feel needs to be spoken. This one rule alone changes everything. Because many people think expressing is the same as processing. It's not. Sometimes expressing is just spreading the emotion into the world and calling it healing. While the real processing, reflection, correction, clarity, never happens. Silence gives you the chance to process privately first. It gives you time to understand what you actually feel before you package it into language. It gives you the ability to choose what is useful to share and what is simply raw emotion looking for a place to land. And when you start doing this, something remarkable happens. People lose their ability to destabilize you quickly. They can still disagree with you. They can still dislike you. They can still misunderstand you. But they can't easily wound you because they don't have the map. They don't know which words to use to create chaos inside you. That doesn't make you invincible. It makes you less predictable in your pain. And that's a form of safety. So what does this look like practically? It looks like not explaining your deepest motivations in conversations that don't deserve them. It looks like keeping your insecurities off the table with people who don't earn trust. It looks like not sharing your next move until it's already moving. It looks like not replying when someone tries to pull your emotions out of you. It looks like being careful about what you say in moments of heat, because heat makes you reveal things you later wish you hadn't. And it also looks like giving yourself permission to be private without guilt, because privacy is not deception. Privacy is a boundary around the most sacred parts of your life. Here's the if-then for this lesson. If you feel the urge to vent or overshare in order to get instant relief, then pause and ask, is this person safe or are they just available? If they're only available, keep it to yourself, write it privately, walk, breathe, let the emotion cool, and then choose a wiser outlet. Relief is not worth the cost of being exposed. Over time, this practice builds a quiet emotional strength. Your peace stops being something other people can easily shake. Your decisions stop being shaped by who knows what about you. Your mind becomes more yours. And when your mind becomes more yours, your life starts moving like a mission, because your attention stops being scattered into commentary and starts being gathered into action, which brings us to the final lesson. 12. Your life starts moving like a mission. Have you ever had the feeling that your days are full, but your life isn't moving? Like you're busy, you're talking, you're reacting, you're explaining, you're staying connected, you're keeping up. And yet, when you zoom out, months pass, and the deeper things you care about are still sitting in the same place. That's what happens when attention is scattered into commentary. Commentary feels like participation. It feels like you're in it. But commentary rarely builds anything. It keeps you near the surface of life, where the noise is loudest and the rewards are quickest, and it trains your mind to seek stimulation instead of progress. Stoicism is blunt about this. A human life is measured by what you devote yourself to, not by what you talk about. Epictetus would say that your primary responsibility is the governance of your own mind, because if the mind is undisciplined, everything else becomes reactive, and reactivity is the enemy of mission. Marcus Aurelius would remind himself that the day is short and the work is clear, and that the only thing that makes a life honorable is using it well. Which means returning again and again to what matters, without being seduced by distractions that feel urgent but don't lead anywhere. This is the final transformation the title is really pointing to, not silence for the sake of silence. Silence is a strategy that gathers your life into one direction. Because when you shut your mouth in the right way, you stop spending your best energy proving that you're someone. You stop maintaining an image. You stop narrating your intentions. You stop defending your choices. You stop reacting to every minor pressure. And what happens is almost unavoidable. The energy you used to waste gets reclaimed. And reclaimed energy wants to be used. It naturally starts pouring into something tangible. Your health, your craft, your career, your learning, your relationships that actually matter, your financial stability, your internal peace. The mind starts asking better questions. Not, how do I look? But, what am I building? Not, do they approve? But, is this aligned with my standards? Not, what should I say? But, what should I do next? That is mission thinking. Mission thinking is when you wake up and the day has a center. Not 10 priorities, not 1,000 tasks, but a center. Something you're moving toward. And once you have a center, decisions become easier because you're not choosing between random options. You're choosing based on whether the option serves the center or distracts from it. This is why people with mission feel calmer. They don't need to entertain every invitation, every argument, every trend, every emotional conversation. They can say no with less friction because they have a yes that matters more. Seneca wrote about time as the only true possession. Not money, not status, time. And the tragedy, he suggests, is that people protect their money but donate their time. Mission is what stops the donation. Mission makes you careful. Mission makes you selective. Mission turns your attention into something guarded because you finally understand that attention is literally your life in liquid form. Silence supports this in a way that's easy to miss. It removes the need to keep explaining your priorities to people who don't share them. If you're constantly explaining, you're constantly returning to the conversation, constantly reopening the loop, constantly re-arguing your own direction. But when you keep your mouth shut, you simply move. You do the next step. You let the calendar show your values. You let your behavior become your argument. And something else happens that is almost spiritual in its simplicity. Your life begins to feel faster, not because time changes, but because waste decreases. When you stop living as a narrator, you stop revisiting everything 10 times. You stop reliving conversations in your head. You stop looking for the perfect words. You stop trying to manage everyone's understanding. That frees up mental bandwidth, and that bandwidth becomes momentum. And momentum is the feeling of a mission. You can feel yourself moving. Now, mission doesn't mean you become harsh or obsessed. Mission means you become clear. The Stoics were not interested in frantic intensity. They were interested in calm strength, the kind where you can endure discomfort without losing your center. You can face criticism without collapsing. You can work without needing immediate praise. You can keep going even when the outcome isn't guaranteed, because your standard is internal. So how do you apply this lesson in daily life? You begin treating your attention like it's sacred. You stop giving it away to commentary that produces nothing. You stop taking every bait. You stop explaining yourself to people who aren't responsible for your life. You stop turning your plans into conversation pieces. You take the next step quietly, then the next, then the next. And here's a powerful detail. Mission doesn't require you to know the entire path. It only requires you to know the next honest step. A lot of people freeze because they want certainty. They want the full map. But Stoicism teaches you to act with courage inside uncertainty, to do what is right without demanding guarantees. Marcus Aurelius didn't control outcomes. He controlled his own actions. That's mission. Here's the if-then for this final lesson. If you catch yourself slipping into commentary, arguing online, replaying conversations, explaining plans, seeking validation through words, then interrupt it by doing one concrete action that moves your life forward, even if it's small. A message that matters, a workout, a page read, a skill practiced, a task completed, a boundary held. Let action replace narration. Because once action becomes your default response, your life starts moving in a new way. Less talk, more proof. Less performance, more direction. Less noise, more mission. And when you live like that long enough, you don't have to convince anyone that your life changed. They'll feel it when they look at you. If you're ready, I'll write the conclusion next in the same style. Clean, powerful, and audio ready. And now, at the end of all of this, I want you to notice something simple, almost uncomfortable in its honesty. Nothing here required you to become louder, sharper, more aggressive, or more confident in the way people usually mean it. The entire shift was the opposite. It was less. Less narration. Less explanation. Less emotional dumping. Less reacting. Less begging to be understood by people who were never trying to understand you in the first place. And if that feels too simple to be true, that's only because we've been trained to believe that change must be dramatic to be real, when in reality, the deepest changes are often quiet enough that nobody notices them until they're already irreversible. Because once you stop talking the way most people talk, you start living the way most people don't live. You stop killing your goals early by spending the reward before the work is done. And instead, you let the only reward that matters arrive in its proper order. Proof first, pride later. You stop depending on willpower as if it's a permanent personality trait, and you begin building discipline the way Stoicism always intended, through repeated action, through calm standards, through small promises that you keep when nobody is watching. You stop flooding the room with words, and suddenly your words matter more, not because you forced respect, but because you stopped diluting yourself. You stop giving away your emotional map in every conversation, and your social world changes because you become harder to pull, harder to bait, harder to steer. You stop exposing your plans to the noise of everyone's opinions, and your execution becomes cleaner, faster, more protected. You stop replying from heat and start replying from principle, and that alone can save you from years of regret. You stop negotiating boundaries like you're asking permission to have standards, and you become steady in a way people can feel. Your life grows quieter, not empty, but clear, because you're no longer maintaining unnecessary loops. Your reputation improves without you chasing it, because reliability begins replacing promises. Your confidence becomes real because it finally has a foundation, and you become harder to hurt because fewer people have access to the parts of you that are still healing. And eventually, the biggest change happens. Your life starts moving like a mission, not because you discovered some secret, but because you finally stopped interrupting your own momentum with constant commentary. So here's what I want to leave you with, not as a command, but as a clean invitation you can test in real life. Choose one moment today where you would normally explain yourself, update someone, react quickly, or fill silence out of discomfort. And instead, pause. Let the pause happen. Let the silence do its work. Then take one small action that moves your life forward, and don't announce it. Keep it private. Keep it clean. Keep it yours. And if you ever wonder whether this is too small to matter, remember what the Stoics were really saying all along. Your life is shaped less by what you intend and more by what you repeatedly practice. Silence, used wisely, is not emptiness. It is space. And space is where your better self has room to breathe, choose, and build. Hold that space. Protect it. And then, without rushing, let your results speak for you.